Hello, I'm Shantae Marsh, co-founder of Big Car Collaborative and director of exhibitions and programs.
And I'm Sean Oreo Jones, co-founder of Treese and rapper musician behind Bless.
In this series, Mari Evans, an audio family album, we are focusing on an American treasure, one of the Black Arts Movement founders and Renaissance woman, Mari Evans. Born July 16, 1919, she was a poet, philosopher, composer, educator, artist, and television personality who improved and inspired the lives of countless citizens in Indianapolis and around the world.
And you will hear in her own words and through her family, Chris Femster, Eric Femster, Matthew Femster, and Navaya Femster, who and what made Mari who she is.
Family was most important to Mari Evans. And so you will hear a chapter from her book, Clarity as Concept, called Family as Foundation.
And we will be sharing the audio from The Black Experience, a TV show that Mari wrote, directed, and most times hosted.
I was fortunate enough to work with Mari for 2 years on a mural of her at 448 Mass Avenue and an exhibit about her. I've read all of her poetry, book of essays. Mari gave me her friendship and a whole new perspective on being a woman of color and an American. Sean, did Mari and her work influence you?
Yeah, Mari's work really influenced me, not only as an artist, but just as a Black man and a human being through the lens of experiencing life and family and trying to find out who I am as a human being. Just her words inspired a lot of things, and it was truly a blessing to meet her after the unveiling of the mural celebration and being able to record an actual reading near Mass Ave, and it's been something that I'll hold close to my heart for the rest of my life.
You recorded her final reading, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, something that I'll never forget.
Well, before we begin, we would like to thank the Women's Fund of Central Indiana and the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts for making this series possible.
In this episode, writer, journalist, and community activist Ariana Beatty reads an excerpt from Clarity as Concept, A Poet's Perspective by Mari Evans, Family as Foundation. And now, without further ado, we begin.
Family as Foundation, Lucille. Our family, like all Black families, ran the gamut when it came to color. But there, the similarities stopped abruptly. We, it seemed, had it all backwards. Somewhere along the line, the group had reversed the value process. Black gave you extra brownie points. Several of us were hued enough to earn stripes. My father, William or Bill, me, Mary Elizabeth, homage to my rather prominent derriere, my slim, handsome cousin, Bill, or more aptly, Willie Lewis, and finally, Lucille, the littlest of the darkest-hued ones, and acknowledgeably, the family beauty. For, in addition to being smoothly and beautifully blacker, she had good hair, the kind we all wanted. Her sister, Annie Ruth, was rhiny, or reddish, and hated it. Rudy and I would watch in loving admiration, after we washed, and sitting around our heads engulfed in towels while they did Lucille. Lucille, the youngest, the blackest, the beauty of the family, who graciously did not lord it over us while they smoothed Vaseline between their palms and with the flat of their hands knocked her damp hair down into deep black shiny waves without even once reaching for the oftentimes painful heat of a straightening comb. Lucille was lovely and knew it, but never spoke of it, except by the aloof little way she carried herself. Lucille was the one who would appear, back straight as a rod, savoring in all apparent innocence, small bites of her portion of whatever treat we had been given when ours was long gone. Pointedly ignoring us, she would sashay slowly by. Her eyes focused only on the treat, never touched ours in triumph. In fact, never acknowledged our plaintive, if embarrassed, whines, "Lucille, give me some." Sometimes our patience tried beyond any accommodation. Annie Ruth or I would pinch Lucille if none of the adults were close by. Nothing, however, ever changed the fact that she was the blackest and had good hair, or that we envied her. Ludi. I ache with remembrance. We were so close, and I was always at her heels. And to unbind the heart, I coaxed the face to reappear and open to her soft spirit. A welcoming, a bringing to life of the small things, the way she would turn from the sink or stove, aproned always. Hair a tender brown welt, a confusion. "Good morning, Mary Sunshine. How pale you are today." The gentle family laughter. No malice. And I, the recipient of love, responding to love. Herself, the gift. Loved and lonely. She had come to surrogate a pride of nieces and nephews after the death of her husband and of her two sisters. Nancy, burdened by almost past movement by 9 children and my own mother, a spirited, independent lady who, despite my father's every effort, drifted away from us from some undefined illness science had yet to name. The man was named Moses, and he usually appeared at some undetermined time after she had settled in and settled us in. He came to share a beer, moments after we were bedded down, his voice soft in the kitchen. We hated him, but she needed someone, and accepting the unobtrusive murmur of their voices, we forgave her, loving her utterly. In the times before Mr. Moses, I trailed her relentlessly. She danced, arms outstretched, and whirled me around. I slept with her, fearlessly, in the feather bed, afraid each night, anxious and nearly traumatized by my fear that her adult bulk would, in sleep, drift to my side and morning would find me dead, engulfed, smothered in the airless depths of the feather bed we shared during the time I was the small guest in her home. I would cling fearfully to the edge of my side of the bed until sleep weakened my grip. Without exception, I awoke safe and relieved each morning. No. Hanging with Aunt Lula was not without its small terrors. An urban child used to another lifestyle, I expected nothing less than light switches and indoor plumbing. So I endured some anxious moments when Ludi lit her apartment's gas lights and the wavering shadows began to grope across the patterned wallpaper to where I stood in the gloom, silent, apprehensive, watchful. Anything was possible. Only when the flame steadied and the shadows no longer lived, I could breathe again. She sang to me in a high, light soprano and unending repertoire that included an always a wistful rendition of Whispering Hope and Flee as a Bird to Yon Mountain. I was her willing audience, and pleased by these performances and moved by the wistfulness in her voice or the plaintiveness of her violin. When Uncle Henry was alive, however, she seemed inordinately happy. While I lived with them, she would let me stand with her in front of her huge dresser mirror and dip, as she did, my finger into the container, opaque and white, that held her face cream. That it did little for either of us was of no concern whatsoever. What mattered was that we were ladies together, doing cosmetics, getting pretty. She gave me every necessary freedom. There were 2 boys to shoot marbles with. I learned to pitch pennies in front of the restaurant. And I had a Greek best friend who was allowed to sit. Among her fascinations was an uncle who owned a dim, musty candy shop where there were very colored and silvered candy-coated almonds in glass jars, and other glass jars containing strange, intriguing items and liquids. And because it was different, it carried an aura of danger. I never went there alone. And when the Greek Orthodox Church paraded, resplendent in all its pageantry, white and red robed priests, glittering red, yellow, silver, and gold encrusted banners flying proudly from stanchions, I watched from a safe distance, walking backwards in front of the parade, bemused, and trying to see as much as I could without getting too close. The Greeks had great parades, scary, but wonderful. My Uncle Henry, a smiling brown-skinned man, owned the Silver Moon Restaurant, and cooking was considered a skill, a high art in our family. One worked at it, lovingly, to make it just right. At 10, I was patiently taught short order cooking 101, to flip an egg in the air and catch it deftly in the skillet without breaking it. Never mind the disasters. We worked at it until I could do it. Then what triumph in the kitchen! I was shown how to make hash browns, golden brown and crusty on the bottom before ever turning them the first time. How to break an egg with one hand without breaking the yolk. That a poached egg should be pretty with the white coagulated and circular, not raggedy. Poached eggs were fun to make. At 10, a high art. I filled salt and pepper shakers and carried them in water glasses out on a tray. I was taught the proper way to set silver moon tables, and on occasion, I was allowed to serve selected customers. I remember a handsome man named Lonnie who came in late each afternoon. He was their favorite. When our part of the day was over, Aunt Lula and I walked home together. I was never frightened, for I knew Aunt Lula was carrying little Mary in her pocket for our protection. The women in our family have always been comfortable with revolvers. Great Amy. The inestimable Amy. I never wonder about my grandfather. Amy is the challenge. It is Amy I want to know. Hers is the top picture of the three oval frames on the section of narrow wall facing the landing. Amy, then my young father, upright and responsible, looking but at 25, still the too old intruder. And finally, the fragile schoolgirl who at 17 still wears a hair bow demurely at the nape of her neck. Her eyes, despite the little we know of her upbringing, are determined. Never mind the unlined face. The three of them on that wall, a permanent vertical line, a loving conundrum I consider almost each time I pass. It is they I return to when I come home from fighting the psychological wars, and it is there on those steps that I sometimes go to sit. I take a cup of coffee or tea, and I silently say some things to them, and they just as silently let me know how they feel about what I've just said. And those are moments filled with serenity and mutual love. Love as tangible as breathing. Yet it is Amy of those enigmatic eyes, Amy who is the challenge, Amy who calls to my spirit. It is Amy that I want to know. Mother, you of the mud pies carefully tapped out of jar lids and bottle tops. The taffy pulls, the raw shredded cabbage with olive oil and fresh lemon juice, long before low cholesterol and high fiber. You of the UNIA meetings, the ecumenical church visits, the scented incense cones and the small spiritualist gatherings. A brown hand held high, fingers clutched over a folded paper, voice insistent, freighted with prophecy. I am coming to an Ella. Is there an Ella in the house? You of the quiet excitement and the reaching, the compulsion to evolve. You I know and love and love and love. But your mother, Amy, great Amy, the picture at the top that has austere look that tells me without equivocation that she has to have been pinioned. I mean pinioned by that old judge to be so indifferently impregnated. And he had to have been mesmerized by her beauty, intrigued, arrogant, his lust aroused, callous and cruel to take her as he would any animal that he could buy and control. Amy. What was her life like then? How did she live? What was her house like? How was it furnished? Did she have a husband present? Long gone? Hardly gone, given her beauty? That she was her own woman is absolutely clear. High-minded, tall, quite sure of herself, but no match for a destructible, malevolent society. It is Amy, mother of your sister Ludie, that I want you to know. Catholicism. Our family had been staunch members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church for as long as I can remember, probably because our denomination allows us choices and the freedom to appreciate all the other ways people worship and the ways people are. Therefore, when my father put me in a convent, nobody was surprised but me. I was 10 and dubious about the whole thing. In the 3 years after my mother's death, I had exploited a newfound, if partial, authority over my own life. The fact that I had no intention of relinquishing any part of that control made me an unlikely candidate for any convent. My father had tried to enter me into the only black boarding school he knew of, a place called Palmer's Institute in Sedalia, North Carolina, but I was too young. Palmer's was an elite school, and I had really wanted to go there, but before I could decide on an alternate plan of action, the two of us were leaving Toledo headed for a white convent in the southern part of Ohio. We made one stop en route to visit a lady my father knew in Cincinnati. Having decided the night my mother died that the rest of my life would be a surreptitious battle waged by me to keep adults off my case, I was already in a protective mode and thinking way ahead. Don't forget her address, I kept reminding myself. Don't forget this address. So when we stood in the doorway as we left, I waved vigorously. My eyes were glued to the house number, 840, 840, 840. And as we passed the street sign, I, at 10, added that to my litany, Court Street, 840 Court Street, 840 Court Street, a destination, a place I could return to in case I had to run, 840 Court Street. In time, I would live there and go to school from there and come to detest the woman. Not because she was mean to me, but because she had a lover her husband didn't know about and she thought I didn't know about. Moreover, she made me use my allowance for lunch instead of giving me a lunch to take, but mostly because she thought I was stupid. She told me early on that she could read my mind, not to play tricks. She showed me huge books on a high shelf in her closet. These, she said, told her how to do it. When I got tired of my mind being under surveillance, I ran some elementary tests. She thought I lied a lot. I really didn't, primarily because I thought she had the advantage and would catch me if I lied. So when she asked me if I bought candy with my allowance, I realized this was a made-to-order litmus test, and I was scrupulous with the truth. No, I replied. Sweet potato pie and a dill pickle. You're lying, she said. I was delighted. She apparently couldn't tell. I want the truth, she said, fixing me with an eye gleaming with meanness. I simulated lying. That's the truth, I whined. Young lady, you're going to tell me the truth or I'm going to get your legs, she said, rising from her chair to go find a switch. My legs tingled as I high jumped and complained. That's the truth. That's the truth. I told you the truth. Call it masochism if you like, but the switching was worth it. The books on the shelf were bogus. She didn't know a thing about me. I could think what I wanted to think, and I could lie if I wanted to. For the rest of my time there, I did both. We reached the convent shortly after leaving Cincinnati. One of the sisters welcomed us, and with no preamble, the duplicity began. They showed my father a small, very sparse but neat room. I would have one of these, they said. This had never been a situation of my choice, and I was increasingly not at all pleased. But they told him everything he needed to hear, and before one could imagine it, they had satisfied him that he was doing the very best he for his poor little motherless daughter, and he was gone. Probably an emotional escape from my demands, he not leave me in this strange place with these people I neither knew nor wanted to know. A nun and I went from virtual reality to reality in a matter of moments. I was taken upstairs, turned over to a middle-aged hunchback woman almost no taller than I. I learned later that she was old, 27 in fact, and that her parents had brought her, left her, and had never come back. This bit of information was the first thing I could get my teeth into fear. It was enough. I would no longer be in his face, and my father would forget me. My only option would be escape. I was ushered into a long, narrow room that seemed to house about 50 girls of various ages, all black. I was given a cot, some linen, and since I had already begun to pout and signal that I just might not comply, the hunchback, to short-circuit that game, helped me to make up the small bed. She was really quite nice, and before long I found myself liking her. But the battle had been joined, and I never let myself forget that she was in the service of the enemy. She issued me uniforms. I refused to have anything to do with them. I announced I would only wear my own clothes. The other girls had begun to form a distant but obviously fascinated ring around the battlefield. A nun was summoned, and from that point on it was me against what must have been a coterie of bewildered nuns. This was before the age of youthful rage and child murderers. I was probably on the far edge of their experience. In the days to come, they would win a few and I would win a few. I refused to wear uniforms, but spent some time on my cot in the dorm before being allowed to wear my own clothes. I did eat the unfamiliar food, and I did work a half day and was only sent to school a half day. Like most 10-year-olds, I had never had to do anything that approached work and was not at all happy at this turn of events. But at the convent, I became a worker expected to deliver a product, and a certain amount of product at that. They had several rows of heavy industrial-type sewing machines. I was shown to one and instructed to sit. But I was terrified and had no intention of trying to learn to do something I could see I might get hurt doing. I quickly became so convincingly stupid that they finally considered the obvious risk and took me instead to a small counter where for the rest of my stay, I would stand for half a day facing the wall and affixing Fruit of the Loom labels onto the underwear the girls who worked on the machines turned out. As I worked, I prayed and prayed and prayed, convinced that God apparently liked Catholics, given the splendor of the convent and as many of them as there were around. Okay, I'm gonna pause. As I worked, I prayed and prayed and prayed, convinced that God apparently liked Catholics, given the splendor of the convent and as many of them as there were around. I hoped I could assure him that I was not totally rebellious and that I loved him despite the spot I was in and had nothing really against Catholics. In fact, I was so submissive and so free of resentment that if he'd just let me get out of here, I'd turn Catholic if that was what it would take to please him. I knew he knew what a major sacrifice it would be for me to leave the African Methodist Episcopal Church, but standing there facing that wall, I said I would. No discernible response. I knew he heard me, but he remained silent. I kept on praying. God and I always had an ongoing relationship. We still do. I knew I could depend on him and that he would watch my back. He still does. I never feel like I'm tackling the world alone. So as I prayed, I knew I just had to be cool. He would let me know when and how to move. Secretly, I thought the nuns were really bad. They served us coffee from a big metal urn when we had to. Secretly, I thought the nuns were really bad. They served us coffee from a big metal urn when we had picnics in the grotto. And of course, I knew children weren't supposed to have coffee. My parents were doing me a favor when on rare occasions they fixed me weak cambric tea with a lot of milk and sugar, enough to make it taste special. The convent seemed to be a huge complex of buildings, some impressive and wonderful, all mysterious. We were not free to explore. We seemed never to be without supervision for long. Late one Sunday afternoon, our group went to Vespers along an unfamiliar but wide, low-ceilinged corridor. It had pointed stained glass windows through which the late afternoon sun threw colorful shadows on the rust-colored tile floor. I deliberately lagged behind, gradually allowing the group to move farther and farther away. "Go on, I'm coming," I called, pretending to be in a hurry. My intent was to find the room reputed to be somewhere along this corridor where the Mother Superior whipped the nuns who were bad. I had never seen this corridor, but I had heard that cries could be heard coming from that room. I searched fearfully, but determinedly, until the distance between me and the group had lengthened, and suddenly I was completely alone. Terrified, I turned and ran the long deserted distance back to safety. Safety, that afternoon, was our play area, the area the group had just vacated to go to Vespers. I would have some time alone, but I knew that when they returned, I would be strategically lurking to reinsert myself into their midst as if I had been there all along. I enjoyed the play area. We could pretty much do as we pleased there, I think. At least I did. What was significant about it for me was the long arched grape door. What was significant about it for me was the long arched grape arbor that ran the length of the area. And the arch did not become significant until the other kids walked through. The other kids were the bad kids. They were the wards of the county. For what reason, we did not know. We assumed it was because they're bad. Their other distinguishing feature was that their parents did not pay for them as ours did. But more significantly, that they were both black and white, all mixed up, not separately white or separately black as we, the paying kids, were. When their long line went through, we never quite knew why, for Vespers or meals, we imagined. We were to stop whatever we were doing and turn our backs to them the minute their line appeared, because they were bad, we supposed. Under some edict as serious as pain of death, we thought, we were not to look at them. Our backs were to be turned. It was too mean, I felt, and I refused to do it. And at 10, I stood there, defiant, facing the line as they went through. I hoped they understood my respect, that I was with them, for them, One Heart. The experience of early Mass at Our Little Lady of Lourdes was unforgettable. Mass seemed to be around 5 o'clock, and the mornings were damp and gray, shrouded in fog. One could see groups of brown, black, or blue-garbed clergy moving through the mist, and always converging lines of children, heads discreetly covered. The white children, whose parents paid for them, were in one group. Black children, whose parents paid, were in another group. And although the white children's quarters abutted ours, the connecting door was always kept shut, and the effort was not just to keep us separate. We rarely caught a glimpse of them, or they of us, I suppose. All I ever knew of them was that they left for Mass first, and we waited until the sounds of their leaving faded before we opened the door. Since I was both awed and confused by the strangeness and magnificence of the surroundings, I am sure my memory is selective, but I do remember that the church structure itself was huge, circular in design, and that it had, I was told, 7 sections or compartments filled with groups that could only glimpse each other distantly. But the celebrants, as they went about the rituals of the Mass, were clearly visible to all. Elevated as they were in the center on an elegant structure, not unlike the grated layers of a wedding cake. I dreaded getting up at 5, but I was captivated by what I would, as an adult, understand to be the surreal quality of the whole experience. From the moment I first knew that I could only go to school half day, I knew that I could never remain at the convent. But it was not until I stood at my counter, Fruit of the Loom labels in hand, praying to be told that I could safely leave, that I decided I had no option, that the longer I stayed, the more I would accommodate the life of the convent and submit to its rules. I knew my own clear understanding of the danger I was in would be replaced by my increasing involvement in their system, thus my accommodation of their rationale and their logic, until eventually I would be who they wanted me to be. Mindless, and theirs. Of course, I had no language for this, no words like brainwashing, but the logic was mine. I knew I had to leave, or they would overwhelm me. They would own me. My father would forget me, and with only a half day of school, I would only be half as smart as my friends on the outside. And despite the occasional days that I hooked just for the excitement of it, I loved school. I wanted to know everything it was possible to know, just for the sheer joy of knowing. By the time I put it all together, I decided the quality of my future life, if in fact I was to have a future, depended entirely on whether I had the courage to run and run fast. I had. When I went to bed one night, I had every intention of running the next morning. I knew where I would go, 840 Court Street, and I knew God would help me get there. I was anxious and scared, but was committed to doing it, and I had absolutely no doubt that I would succeed. The next morning, as I had planned, I malingered through the usual chaos of preparing for Mass. The line is leaving, and I am still calling, "Go on, I'll be right there." No one will care if I get in trouble for being late. I dress carefully but fast. I do not worry about being identified. I am not wearing a uniform. I'm in my own clothes. I have no money, and I have steeled myself to leave all my cherished possessions. My stacks of lovely handkerchiefs, my music, my dresses, my pastel green camera. I know I can't carry anything. The last child has disappeared, and I open the door that separates black children from white. From this point on, I am targeted. I am out of place, and I know it. I cannot plead ignorance and beg for mercy. I am trespassing. A little instinct and a lot of listening to the voice I need to hear, and I am out of the white kids area, running between desks and through what is obviously administration and out of the front doors to an absolutely scary, broad, unobstructed entry area. No trees, no bushes, it leads to the highway. The fog is lifted, and I can be seen for days if anyone is looking out of any convent window anywhere. I keep to the edge of the broad, empty area, and bending as if there were cover, I run for my life. I reach the road and turn left, because that is the side that I'm on. I stop running and walk, as if I know what I'm doing. I know I must not appear to be a fugitive. I'm not running now, but I still try to move as quickly as possible. The sun has just burned off the last of the fog, and there is a soft orange glow in the sky across the road. It bathes the road ahead. But then new information kicks in. You are most likely going the wrong direction because all the heavy traffic is going the opposite way. Obviously, most folk leaving an outlying area will be going to work in the city, toward Cincinnati, that is. I berate myself for not having thought about this, and I'm terrified at the thought of retracing my steps based on this kind of logic and having, in the process of reversing myself, to recross the broad, bare expanse of paved driveway that leads to the convent's administrative building. I understand I have no option. I understand I have squandered valuable time and that I may be just as wrong going in the opposite direction, but I have to believe God's going to get me through this, so I take a deep breath, turn back, and run. When I reach the broad place again, hoping the search for me is not already underway. But I'm now moving in the same direction as the stream of traffic. In time, I reach a grocery store. There's a streetcar there. I need transportation out of this area, away from the danger of being recaptured. So that streetcar is obviously there waiting for me. I have no money, but that should not be a problem. I'm a child in desperate need. It is early. The store is empty except for two men, both white, the clerk and a customer. I approach them. I can handle this. Do you know how I can get to Cincinnati? I ask in my most innocent child voice. They are mesmerized. I am an apparition, a little black girl, clean, decently dressed, but here in this isolated satellite area? What are you doing out here? How did you get out here? How old are you anyway? They asked in almost concert. I could deal with that. In my own clothes, I could not be identified as a convent escapee. I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Toledo. My father and I are visiting a lady in Cincinnati, and I got separated from them downtown yesterday, and I got on the wrong streetcar and wound it up here and didn't have any money to get back to Cincinnati. Where'd you stay last night? One questioned. I slept on some back steps so no one would see me, and so I'd feel safe until morning, and I still can't get back to Cincinnati because I don't have any money. Well, here, the clerk said, reaching into the cash drawer, I'll give you car fare back to town. Do you know where you're going? The other one asked. Yes, sir, I said stoutly. 840 Court Street. That's where she lives. What's her name? Asked the clerk. We'll call her. They must be worried. I don't know, mister, I said. I forgot her name. I just met her yesterday. I'll watch her, the customer told the clerk. I'll tell her where to get off and when we get to Court Street. They were good and decent men, happy at having helped a little Negro girl in trouble. And I was overjoyed that they had helped a little Negro girl in trouble. The stranger alerted me to the stop. I thanked him profusely and got off. In a few minutes, I was knocking on the door of 840 Court Street. What in the world was all the lady could say? She heard me out, got right on the telephone, and called my father in Toledo. When her telephone rang a little later, I could hear the high-pitched hysteria coming out of the telephone. She's missing, they were telling her, but don't be alarmed. We've called the police, and we're all out looking for her. Don't worry, the lady said when she finally had a chance to break in. She's sitting right here at the breakfast table. I never had to go back to the convent, but they kept my green camera, my handkerchiefs, and the music I never got to use. Color, unconsciously conscious. When I was 5, I knew that life was a game one played and that controlling the board or the pieces would be difficult. Nobody told me that. I just understood it. And I knew that the game board was about color and control. And nobody had ever said that to me, but I knew it. And at 5, I was neither subtle nor discreet. So it was that at 5, freshly bathed, braided, beribboned, and before supper splendid in a colorful little cotton dress, I sat on the top step between the hedges. I waited, almost bursting with my knowledge of the world. A small friend came to join me on the top step. Don't say anything, I whispered. Just do what I do. And then, almost on cue, one appeared, a tall white man. I left the step skipping. My playmate joined me, and together we air floated down the sidewalk until we met and passed him. Then, circling back, we stopped a few paces from his feet. and he, momentarily impeded, stopped and tolerantly looked down at what I imagine he saw as two clean but audacious little pickaninnies. And I, looking the length of his tall frame into a face whose sole significance was its whiteness, spoke to him, to my innocent playmate, and to myself, I suppose, for I imagine I had to hear those words. That, I said to and about this tall white presence that I subliminally understood to be my ultimate and ongoing adversary, is one reason I'm glad I'm colored. As defining moment was over and we all moved on. I proudly, I suppose. Having announced at 5 that I knew what life would be about and that I was up to the challenge, my mother never knew. What seemed significant is that I had not been politicized. No one talked to me about race. At that point in time, children responded to calls. Eat your breakfast, go play, come take your bath, dinner's ready, go wash your hands. And it was worth your life to be caught loitering near the sotto voce murmurings that marked serious adult conversations. Besides, I had a certain diffidence about adults. It was clear to me that I understood more about them than they understood about me. Although I minded, I dismissed on a grand scale what passed for their logic. I understood why my mother insisted that I ask for permission to gather the satiny brown buckeyes that I coveted and that littered the yard of the white lady who lived across the street. But I didn't respect the edict. I simply obeyed it, with rocks in jaw, reluctance. For as long as I can remember, the chessboard and the pieces have been black and white, an almost genetic facing off. The strange and unnatural recognition of adversaries from some time before time itself. It was not about hatred. It is about understanding that this is a pas de deux, that we will walk for the rest of what time we have left. It was then, it is now, regrettably. Change has been more cosmetic than spiritual or sociopolitical. All transition merely language, I once wrote in a poem entitled Alabama Landscape. Despite anything we may think we know about the inconsequence of color as an indicator of value, it remains the signal referent for this country's deepest, most affecting problems. So when I asked in 1989 by David Hopp, the writer-editor for Indiana Humanities Council, to join 31 other creative artists in writing about what it meant to be a creative person living and working in Indiana, my only question was, what other Black writers have you asked? Not, how much will you pay for such a piece? David replied that at that point, they had only asked the well-known poet Etheridge Knight, so I hurriedly agreed to participate. There must be a Black voice. Between us, Etheridge and I would say what needed to be said. And so, I began my piece with what I understood as central to my life, my color.